Welcome to this audio recording by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to promoting public awareness of global issues and the ways in which they affect the Dallas-Fort Worth region. Become a member today at dfwworld.org and help us connect North Texas with the world. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it.
Well, Hasina, thank you very much. And Jim and all of you who've come tonight to participate in a discussion. I was told that I should speak for about 20 minutes, and the two respondents would respond for about 30 seconds each. Well, maybe I've got this all confused, but in any event, I couldn't be more pleased to be here. And I was on the phone this afternoon with Bob Schieffer on something else, and I told him I was in Dallas. He said, "What are you doing there?" And I told him I was coming to see you all. He said, "That is a great organization." So you are, of course, known far and wide. And you're going to love Lou Dobbs. He is tough as nails. I was with him in New York about a week ago, and he's all over this issue. Let me tell you, first of all, I graduated in a high school senior class from a town of 300 people. The senior class was 9 students, and I was in the top 5. And that meant in my hometown I was qualified to do almost anything. And going from a town of 300 people to the university and then out of state to get a master's degree, I thought I learned something, and then I got involved in politics and found my way to the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate, and I'm here with a great congressman, Martin Frost. I watched him work and work beside him when I was in the U.S. House for a long, long time, and I know Texas is proud of his public service. Martin, it's good to be with you. And, Professor, it's nice to be with you. Let me tell you my passion about writing this book. We live on this planet of ours, and we circle the sun, and we have about 6.3 billion neighbors. One half of them have never made a telephone call. One half live on less than $2 a day. 1.5 billion of them don't have daily clean access to potable water. And somehow, through divine providence, we ended up in this little space called the United States of America. It's not particularly large, but it's extraordinary what we've built here. We built a way of life in this country through great difficulty. It has never been easy. Risk takers, entrepreneurship, workers. In my book, I describe a lot of that. I tell about James Filer. James Filer died, in my book, I said, of lead poisoning. Actually, James Filer was shot 54 times. You know why he was shot? Because in 1914, he believed that coal miners who went down into the ground to dig for coal should be able to feel like they were going into a safe workplace and should be paid appropriately. For that, he gave his life. We've been through lots of struggles to create this way of life, standards, work standards, rights, and we struggled. And we created something very unusual on this earth, a standard of living that created a burgeoning middle class, an expanding middle class with the capability to produce and consume. What we've done is pretty extraordinary. Now, let me tell you, there's a different standard of living that exists in other parts of the world, and I've been there. Port-au-Prince, Cité Soleil, just outside of Port-au-Prince, Haiti, one of the poorest areas, the most gripping poverty you'll ever see on this earth. Rural China, in some of those areas, some very difficult circumstances. Some of the rural areas in Vietnam, the refugee camps in Guatemala. We have different ways of life, different standards of living in different parts of the world. But here, through a combination of risk takers and capital and entrepreneurs and workers, we built something extraordinary. Now, however, there are, with the growth particularly of large corporations through blockbuster mergers, there's a notion that this is a global economy. And indeed it is, and I couldn't change it if I wanted to. That's not my point. It is a global economy. But the global economy has galloped along without the development of rules. And we are told somehow that this is some homogenized way of life for the world. It's sort of an evening of things up. And so we've got now enterprises that are larger than governments. Of the 100 largest economies in the world, 51 are corporations. We have enterprises that are larger than governments who have decided on this strategy. We want to circle the globe and produce where we can pay people 30 cents an hour. We want to sell into the most established marketplace, the United States especially. And we want to run the income through the Cayman Islands and avoid paying taxes. I'm telling you, that doesn't add up for this country's future. And if you doubt me, let me take the back end first. There's a little White House, 5 stories tall, on Church Street in the Cayman Islands, quiet little street. It's called the Uglin House. It is home officially to 12,748 corporations. Oh, they're not there. Lawyers have given them that address to avoid paying taxes. Now let me go to the front end and tell you that if you want Mexican food, yes, you could go to a restaurant here, or you could just buy Fig Newton cookies. They left for Monterrey, Mexico. Huffy Bicycles left for China. Radio Flyer, Little Red Wagon, 110-year-old company, they went to China. Etch-a-Sketch went to China. I could talk about China, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Vietnam, offshore manufacturing platforms. What's the purpose of all this? Well, let me describe it through the lens of Huffy Bicycles. The people that worked for Huffy Bicycles made $11 an hour plus benefits. They liked their jobs. For a century, they and their families and their relatives worked for Huffy Bicycles. They all got fired. Huffy Bicycles are now made in Shenzhen, China, because that's the way Walmart has suggested it be done. It reduces prices for consumers and fattens the treasury of those that sell them. So Huffy Bicycles left for China. Actually, they had to take the decal of the American flag off Huffy Bicycles. They replaced that with the globe. And the folks at Huffy, who on their last day of work drove out of their parking lot, and they left an empty pair of shoes in the space where their cars used to park, to say to the company, you can move our jobs to China, but you're never going to fill our shoes. I know where those Huffy Bicycles are made now. I tracked that down. They're in Shenzhen, China. They're made by people that work for 33 cents an hour. They work 7 days a week, 12 to 14 hours a day. And the central question is, have we come to the point where American workers must compete against 33 cent an hour labor? Can they? No, they can't. Should they? I don't think so. So you say, you know what, Byron? That's manufacturing. Get over it, for God's sake. Low-wage stuff. That's moving. Just get over it. You don't understand. You're a xenophobic isolationist stooge, and you can't see over the horizon. We all see it. You can't. Get over it. Well, then, if it's not about bicycles, if it's really not about low-wage manufacturing or textiles, and textiles have largely left, as you know. You remember the dancing grapes? One guy was dressed as red grapes. The other guy was dressed as green grapes. You remember those television commercials for underwear, Fruit of the Loom? I mean, who would take a job dancing as grapes? But they did, and Fruit of the Loom danced right out of our country. There's no Fruit of the Loom underwear made in America. So textiles left. And you might say, why don't you get over it, for God's sake? Let's make textiles where you can hire people for 10 cents an hour. And yes, I can tell you where they hire people for 12 cents an hour, 12-year-old kids, and work them 12 hours a day. And by the way, there's an equivalent population of the United States, kids working, almost 250 million kids between ages 5 and 14. Should the American worker compete with that? Be required to compete with that? The answer is no. And you say, well, that's textiles and manufacturing of bicycles and little red wagons. Get over it. This is high-tech stuff. So then I say to you, well, JetBlue. Do you remember when JetBlue was flying over Los Angeles dumping fuel with the front nose wheel askew? And they were wondering, and it was live on every network about 9 months ago. Do you remember that? And wondering whether it's going to crash and whether the people are going to get killed. Well, they brought that front nose wheel down that was askew, and the fireball and the smoke, and they landed, and everybody was safe, and good for them, and God bless them. And JetBlue is a good airline. Did you know, by the way, that JetBlue flies A320 Airbuses, empty to El Salvador for maintenance? That airplane didn't happen to go to El Salvador, but did you know that JetBlue flies empty A320 Airbuses to El Salvador for its maintenance? Is that low skill? I don't think so. You feel better about that? One half of U.S. Airlines maintenance is now outsourced, some of it out of this country. So you say, well, that's just aircraft mechanics. Well, what about Natasha Humphreys? Natasha Humphreys, she did everything right. She went to Stanford, young African-American girl, became an engineer, went to work for Palm Pilot. Her last job, by the way, was to train the engineer from Bangalore, India, that replaced her for a fraction of the price of her salary. One of the things she could do about it. So is this just about manufacturing or textiles? And we just need to train more engineers? Does all this add up for our country? What does it mean for the auto worker, the steel worker, the craftsman, the metal fabricator, the aircraft mechanic, the software engineer? And does that matter? I think we have a situation where we're kind of all asleep We have a $700 billion a year trade deficit. It's actually more than that, but I'm rounding it off. $700 billion a year, $2 billion a day. You can make a case that our budget deficit is money we owe to ourselves. You can't make that case with the trade deficit. That's money we owe to other countries. Every single day we're selling $2 billion worth of our country to other countries. The largest holder of that debt now is China and Japan. President Bush holds meetings frequently, and some woman stood up at one of his meetings, and it was on television, and she said, "Mr. President, I'm working three jobs to try to make ends meet." And he says, "Isn't that fantastic?" Well, no, it's not fantastic, for God's sake, to have to work three jobs to make ends meet. You need jobs that pay well, with good wages, decent benefits. And what is happening in our country is this. We are seeing downward pressure on wages, salaries, and benefits. And Alan Blinder, mainstream economist, former vice chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, says there are 42 to 56 million tradable jobs, or 42 to 56 million American jobs that are subject to outsourcing. Some you can't outsource. You got to see the back of the head of the taxi driver, so you can't outsource the taxi cab driver, right? But there are 42 to 56 million jobs potential to be outsourced, and even those that remain, he says, will put downward pressure on wages because they'll be competing with those elsewhere in the world who are willing to work for much, much less. Now, quickly, trade agreement after trade agreement has been incompetently negotiated and then embraced by presidents, Republicans and Democrats, and then embraced enthusiastically by the Congress. And I'll give you some examples quickly. NAFTA, some of you are certainly welcome to say NAFTA is a great success. To me, when you have a trade surplus with a country of $1.5 billion, and then some years later you have a trade deficit of $40 to $50 billion, that's spelled failure. The three largest imports to this country from Mexico are automobiles, automobile parts, and electronics, all the product of what had been high-skilled labor in our country. This is classically a failure. Let me describe China just for a moment. We have a $200 billion trade deficit with China. Next year, on the streets of Dallas, you're going to see Chinese automobiles that are sold in this country. In fact, a company called Chery, which is only one letter away from Chevy and is producing a QQ car to be sold here, will be moving their cars into our marketplace, and they are ramping up a very large automobile export industry. When they get here, we will charge a 2.5% tariff on Chinese cars sold in the United States. By agreement, when we sell U.S. cars to China, they will charge a 25% tariff on our cars sold in China. So we have lined up an agreement with a country with whom we have a $200 billion trade deficit on bilateral automobile trade. It's okay for them to charge a tariff that is 10 times our tariff on bilateral automobile trade. Whoever negotiated that ought to be arrested promptly. I mean, it is unbelievable what they have done to pull the rug out from under this country's interests. But it is not just that. I just use that as the tip of the iceberg to say, can we compete with that? And we can't compete with that, nor should we expect to or be asked to. We have a situation in this country where we are engaged in international trade in a way that is, in most cases, concessional, a product of incompetent trade negotiations, and second, in the book I've described the soft-headed foreign policy component of trade, because almost all of our trade is with countries that have managed trade programs, and ours, by contrast, we run through the State Department, which is the soft-headed foreign policy, and almost always concede the point by pulling the rug out from under our producers and also our workers. And I'm just telling you, this won't last. This cannot last. We have all these people walk around chanting about free trade. Free trade, free trade. Put robes on them, give them some symbols, stand them on street corners. Call it a religion. Free trade means nothing to me. What means something to me is fair trade in a global economy in which we attempt to try to pull others up, but we should not do anything that pushes our standards down. This is a way of life we've built. And somehow in this new day of free trade, we've discovered that it doesn't matter what happens here. What matters is the ability to produce on an offshore platform where you could pay pennies and then sell the product here. That will not last long. How will the next consumer buy the cheapest gallon of mustard or 12-pack of underwear at a big box retailer if they're out of work? You tell me how that works 2 years, 5 years, or 10 years from now. I submit to you it doesn't. There's no thoughtful debate about trade policy at all in the Congress none with presidents, Republicans or Democrats, and I decided to write a book just to upset everybody. And I've done actually a pretty damn good job of that. So let me close with one story. And Martin Frost was there when this happened. It was the day that Lech Walesa spoke in the U.S. House of Representatives to a joint session of Congress. And his story is one that you know because of the history books, but I want to tell you what he said that day. It was a Saturday morning in Gdansk, in a shipyard in Gdansk, Poland. And Lech Walesa was an electrician. He'd been fired, unemployed electrician. He wasn't injured. Unemployed electrician. He'd been fired from his job for leading a strike against the communist government. And so it was Saturday morning, and he was in the shipyard leading another strike, and the communist secret police grabbed him and began to beat him furiously, and bloodied him badly, and took him to the edge of the shipyard to the fence and hoisted him up over the fence, over the barbed wire, threw him on the ground, and he lay there face down in the dirt bleeding. And Lech Walesa was speaking to a joint session of Congress, and he said, "I lay there bleeding face down in the dirt wondering what to do next. Didn't have a job, had just been beaten." Well, the history books tell us what he did next, and he told us that day as well. He said, "I pulled myself back up, and I crawled back over the fence back into the shipyard." And 10 years later, he was announced at the door of the U.S. House of Representatives as president of the country of Poland. Now, he wasn't a military leader, wasn't a business executive, wasn't an intellectual. He was an unemployed electrician. And here's what he said to us. "We believed that people ought to be free to choose their own destiny. We called ourselves Solidarity. We believed that workers ought to be free to choose their own destiny." He said the communists had all the guns. The communist government had all the weapons. We had none. They had all the bullets. We had none. We were armed only with an idea that people ought to be free to choose their own destiny. And he said, "Ideas are more powerful than guns." What is the idea? What are the set of ideas that created the foundation and the platform for what we built in this country? Good jobs that pay well, a burgeoning, expanding middle class. What's happening to those ideas today? And does it matter? Does it matter at all? And isn't the best symbol of that the withdrawal of the American flag from Huffy Bicycles, replaced by a globe? And by the way, just one more point, Huffy Bicycles not only fired their workers, moved their jobs to China, then the Chinese bought the carcass of the company and turned the retirement benefits for the Huffy employees over to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which actually completes the transaction, doesn't it? I'm telling you, it doesn't add up. And I've written a book that's a tough book, but it ends with hope. I couldn't do this job. I couldn't go to the Capitol building if I didn't have great hope for the future. And I talk about solutions that I think we ought to do to put this country back on track, because I believe it's off track. Tom Friedman will argue the opposite case. He writes a book, "The World is Flat." Of course, that's nuts. The world's not flat. He knows better than that. But he's selling 100,000 copies a book, or a month, rather. And it's an entertaining book as well, but dead wrong, at least from my perspective. You're really nice to come here tonight. And I've sort of given you a rat-a-tat-tat of kind of part of what's in the book. I look forward to having more of an aggressive discussion about these issues, because this is really important for this country's future, about who we are and who we're going to become. Thank you very much. God bless you.
Can we ask questions?
After we're going to react, and then there'll be time for questions. And I promise not to talk too long, so that there will be plenty of time for questions. I actually have read both books. I've read Friedman's book, and I've read this book. And I would argue that they are not entirely mutually exclusive, although some of the concepts are. And Friedman makes the case that we are an international society and that business is going to be run on an international basis, and I think that is the reality. Senator Dorgan, who I've served with for a number of years and have a great deal of respect for, has some very interesting solutions to this problem. And they need to be debated, and they need to be debated in Congress. And some of them have been presented to the Congress and voted down, which is interesting. I'm going to go through a few points, but, Byron, there's one thing you would not have no way of knowing, that the fellow who was the red grapes in that commercial, Reggie McDaniel, was the director of the Dallas Repertory Minority Theater 35 years ago, before he went to Hollywood to make that commercial. And my sister Carol, who was the artistic director of that theater, worked with him. And he later had, he's no longer alive, but he later had kind of an interesting career. But that was his introduction to Hollywood, being in that commercial.
Reggie, he'll be in my next book. Thank you, Martin.
Some of the things that, that Senator Dorgan points out in the book, I believe, are things that the Congress needs to do, and there needs to be an agitation for it to do. And the most concrete things deal with tax policy. It is wrong that we have tax policy in this country that rewards companies that move their headquarters out of the United States by giving them favorable tax treatment and rewards companies for creating subsidiaries outside the United States and maintaining their profits in those subsidiaries and not paying tax on them in the United States until they have the opportunity on a very reduced rate and a tax holiday to bring some of that money back into the United States. The tax policy of this country should not be promoting and making it easy for corporations to move jobs out of the United States. That doesn't mean that major corporations don't have the right to seek the lowest cost goods that they can. If they want to seek, if Walmart wants to purchase items made in China, they have every right to do that. But we should not have a policy that promotes the moving of jobs outside the United States and makes it easier for our major corporate entities to do that. We ought to be doing everything we can to preserve American jobs. One of the other points that Senator Dorgan touches on, and he touches on a variety of things in the book, is that we have to do something about health care in this country. I mean, the major automobile manufacturers talk about the fact that there's a $1,500 health care cost built into every car that comes off the line in Detroit or in Arlington, Texas, at the General Motors plant, wherever it is. And that means that our products are not competitive often on a cost basis with automobiles made outside the United States, or even made inside the United States by foreign manufacturers. Most of our foreign competitors have some form of national health care so that the companies themselves do not have to bear the burden of that cost. And in 1993, there were a number, when President Clinton first took office and talked about health care, there were a number of major corporations in this country who applauded the effort to get the government involved in health care and to make it more affordable for them to provide health care or for health care to be provided for their employees. Unfortunately, that didn't go anywhere. You can debate whether the controversial aspects of that particular plan, but until we do something about health care costs in this country, that's going to make it even more difficult for American companies, particularly manufacturing companies, to be competitive with the rest of the world. On the flip side of that is that our automobile companies have not been very forward-looking and have not taken steps to make products that compete on fuel efficiency with foreign manufactured products. And my wife and I went looking for a new car recently. I've always, since I was 20 years old, I had always owned an American car. First car that I ever owned was a 1957 Plymouth that my father bought for $500 when I went away to college, used. And I've owned American products ever since then. But I broke that string last spring because I wanted a hybrid and I wanted a car that was fuel efficient, and American manufacturers are not making cars that are competitive with Japanese products on that basis. So There has to be a little bit of both. We have to do everything we can to help the American automobile industry with some of its costs, but they have to do something to be more competitive, and they have to stop fighting fuel efficiency standards that Congress has attempted to legislate and that the President has now asked for increased fuel efficiency standards. One of the other things, and I don't remember, Byron, how much you talked about education in the book, but education is critical for this country. And we have got to do everything we can to improve the educational system so that we are producing workers who can compete with foreign countries. The greatest risk, I believe, for this country, and this is combined with our failure to address immigration policy, the greatest risk for our country is that we will have an uneducated underclass that can't get jobs, and that we will ultimately have civil unrest in this country because we will have a large group of people who have not been provided an adequate education and who cannot find employment. And that is probably the greatest long-term threat that faces our nation. And I hope that we will be smart enough and wise enough to deal with that. Byron's book is tough, and he has a lot to say that people need to listen to. You won't agree with everything, every point he makes in his book, but I urge every one of you to read it, to buy it, to read it, and to think about it, and to figure out how, as a country, we solve some of these problems. Thank you very much.
Good evening. Senator, you want a response in 30 seconds. As millions of students will attest, you cannot get a professor to shut up in 30 seconds. But I will try to be as brief as possible. Let me start by saying that Congressman Frost mentioned about the book and its thoroughness. I was really struck by the fact, as I read books like this, I always try to find holes in them. Must be my nature. And I was struck by the fact that at every point, I kept thinking, I bet he didn't think about that. And sure enough, in the next two or three pages, he managed to hit those points. So beyond the where you might think your opinions might lie and whether you agree or disagree, what I was really struck by was the fact that it was very comprehensive in terms of thinking about all the different aspects of the issues that you're trying to address. So that was, I think, a very nice feature of the book. Let me just make a few comments, and hopefully we'll hit some other things during the discussion. I'd like to start by an issue of a definition. We hear the term outsourcing, and we tend to use it in a very broad sense. And actually, what we mean by that is something that encompasses two very different terms. One is outsourcing itself, which means a company that gets somebody else to build or perform some function. And that somebody else could be down the street, could be in the next town, could be across the world. But it's just the fact that you're getting some other company to do it. Offshoring is a term that refers to getting something done somewhere else, that somewhere else being another country, overseas. And who's doing that could be employees of your firm that are located elsewhere, or could be an outsource offshore situation. Okay. Now, if you think about it a little bit, outsourcing by itself is not necessarily bad for the economy, right? Because outsourcing enables companies to do what they do best. In business school, we talk about the notion of core competency. And the idea is that every company should focus on what it does best and let other companies that do other things better than they do perform those functions. And what has happened over the past 50 years is that with technology, with improved business practices, we've learned how to sort of slice and dice what happens within this big monolithic company and break it out into little pieces that different companies can do. And what happens is you get more efficient companies that can therefore be more profitable. That's a good thing. Now, offshoring is a different matter. Okay. Offshoring is where you're now taking something that you're performing in this country, whether within your company or elsewhere, and sending it somewhere else. That's implicitly going to have implications for jobs, okay, and a shifting of the resource pool. So if you think about, I don't think we really argue much about outsourcing. I think that's as I said, I think most companies feel that that's a good thing. It's offshoring that's really the issue that we need to talk about. And if you think about offshoring, it's a pure efficiency play. It's simply, if there's a way to do something cheaper somewhere else, and if you can get people that can perform the same function at a lower cost somewhere else, then you try to exploit that. Okay. Now, where that plays out and with the logic behind that, at least to some extent, is that if that happens, and certainly you're going to lose jobs as that happens, but down the road, as those economies do better, they're going to create markets, and that's going to enable those countries to buy our goods and services. Okay, so we've got a bigger market, we've got a more efficient market, and everyone's happy. Unfortunately, that doesn't work. And that doesn't work because, as the senator points out, we don't have this level playing field. Tom Friedman's flat world implicitly assumes that somewhere along the way it's flat, which means that it's level, right? But it's not level. And what happens is that you get into situations where we deal with countries where we have work being done, and those countries have markets which are much more controlled by governments and other institutions so that they can pretty much dictate where they buy stuff, what they buy, and so on. And so even if the individual might be interested in a free economy, it doesn't happen. So I think that's something that I think is worth keeping in mind. Now, some of the proponents of offshoring argue based on the historical effect of manufacturing offshoring, which the senator talks a lot about in his book. And one of the things that happened when manufacturing offshoring took place was that the economy shifted. We went from a manufacturing-based economy to a much more of a services-based economy. And part of what happened in that process was we had a whole bunch of new industries that evolved or expanded. So we had things like financial services, information services, entertainment, travel, healthcare that blossomed over the past couple of decades as more of the skilled labor shifted and went into some of those sectors. The interesting question is, now as we are seeing those industries facing offshoring, as we find that we can have engineers doing design or architects doing design or even medical services being provided in other countries, where do you go? Okay. Where does labor go at that point? If you cannot do manufacturing and you cannot do services, where do you go? We talk about the food chain. You move up the food chain from manufacturing to services. Well, is there room any further up the food chain that labor can go to? And that's an interesting question, and I think that's where the dilemma lies. Now, there's a separate question, and I want to just kind of throw this out there. As Congressman Frost mentioned, the issue of whether our companies produce the things that people want. The fact that if you have U.S. companies not making things that have the demand that you would want, so for example, if you look at whether it's automotive, whether it's electronics, whether it's foods, except there's a bunch of industries that fashion and so on, the bunch of industries where consumers tend to say, well, we want to have our Sony, camcorders, et cetera, et cetera. Now, that's a different problem from the offshoring problem, because offshoring is rarely done because the other labor sources are better. It's done because they are cheaper. Okay? So that's a different motivation. And the issue of preference is a different problem. In other words, U.S. companies have to get back to where we are producing things that people want. And I think that is a separate problem. The interesting question is, if you then step back and say, kind of going back to my earlier point about the whole idea of where do we go in terms of preferences, one question is, what do we do best? And if you think about when I think about some of the things that we are really, in business school we call it defensible strengths, we think of things like technology. We think of higher education. We think of innovation and creativity. And we think of capital. These are things, managing, creating capital, and all these other aspects. These are things that we do better than anybody else. What is interesting is, in my opinion, and I think of some others, what we don't do very well is making things cheaper than anybody else. And there's some interesting examples of that. Just this week, Walmart has actually surrendered its market in Germany and is backing out of Germany. And the reason is that it cannot sell as cheaply as its competitors. So the question is, you know, there are factors that went into that. It's not simply a case of, well, not being cheap enough. But the point is that they are not able to, because of those factors, not able to produce and sell as, not produce, but sell as cheaply as some of the other companies. There's also the other extreme, before I get to that other extreme, let me point out, so if you talk about technology, right, we have the best technology in the world. What feeds that is our higher education system. And here's an interesting dilemma. We have one of the best, in fact, the best higher education system in the world, and we have a much poorer secondary and elementary education system. Okay? So there's this very big disconnect that happens. And so anytime you have a situation where you've got a labor force that's going through that early stage of education and then going into the workforce, as opposed to the portion that's going through higher education and going to the workforce, you get very different levels of competitiveness. And that's something that's a real challenge that I think that needs to be addressed. But if you look at in a strange kind of way, higher education is reverse offshoring. I came to this country because for a country like India, it was actually cheaper to let the US provide the higher education. Think about it, okay? So they didn't send us in a systematic way, but we came over, right? And now what's happened is that many of the folks who came here have actually gone back, whether to India, to China, to Europe, etc., and they've gone back and they have participated in the enormous growth in those countries. That's offshoring happening the right way, right? Because that's where you're getting this flow back. Now, If you can get that leveling of the field in some of these other aspects where you're getting offshoring, I think things would be a lot better, but it's not happening. An interesting comment that I heard when I've traveled in some of these countries is society is moving from a pyramid to a diamond structure. I don't know if anybody's heard that notion. But what's happening is that going from a very small upper class to a little larger middle class and a very huge underclass, it's moving to a situation where they're getting a much larger middle class, okay, as opposed to having a big underclass. Now, that's going to take a long time in many of these countries, but the point is that that's the direction they're moving. An interesting question is, what's the direction we are moving in the United States? And some would argue that we are actually moving in a direction towards an hourglass structure, almost the opposite. Okay, we're moving to lots of really rich people, okay, the owners, the investors, and lots of very poor people, which are the workers. So if you look at these issues of you know, whether it's good or bad, the problem is it depends on who you ask. Because if you ask the people who are on the upper end of the hourglass, it is actually very good. If you ask people in the lower half, it's terrible. So that's why I think you don't get nice, clean answers about this whole offshoring issue. So I think, you know, if you think about solutions, I think Senator Dorgan has mentioned and talked about a number of very, valid and important ways that we can address some of these things, these problems. I think on a very high level, one of the issues that also needs to be addressed is how to get back to our strengths. As long as companies and industries are competing on price, on cost, offshoring is going to be a part of a downward spiral. You're going to send work outside. It's going to cause pressures on less income here, less spending power, even more pressure on prices, and the spiral is going to go downward. So the question is there a way to change that and to go to where we exploit innovation and creativity and move that to drive the spiral upward? And if you think about it, American companies are actually very good at doing just that. Okay, there's lots of very good examples of that. I mean, if you look at Apple, if you look at Starbucks, if you look at GE Medical Systems, if you look at Boeing. I was talking to folks from the Cleveland Clinic. That's a huge healthcare enterprise, which is actually the hub of a worldwide base of medical expertise. Okay, so I think that's the kind of stuff that we have to kind of find ways to exploit. Now, is it going to affect the hourglass bottom right away? I don't think so, but I think it's going to be one thing that may make a big difference. Okay, so those are some thoughts that I want to put out there, and hopefully we can get some more discussion on that. Thank you.
Well, I wanted to thank our speakers today for some very, very interesting thoughts, and I'm sure that people have a lot of questions. I am going to, if you don't mind, ask the first question, and I ask to Senator Dorgan and Congressman Frost both for your opinions on this issue. I'm an immigration attorney. I work here in Dallas, and our firm represents a large number of U.S.-based and foreign-based companies who have headquarters here in Dallas and other places here in Texas. This year, we have a big debate going on U.S. immigration, both on business immigration as well as general, we'll call it an amnesty, call it a legalization, but generally immigration involving what many people consider to be lesser-skilled and undocumented workers here in the U.S. But what my clients are facing is a year when the general workhorse visa that we use for professional workers, we call it the H-1B visa, there's a quota every year on the number of H-1B visas that can be issued each year to new employees. The quota is supposed to last the entire fiscal year, and this year the quota lasted for about 58 days. And our clients are now faced with the possibility that they cannot hire new foreign talent for about the next 10 months in the United States. And to kind of bring a lot of the issues that we talked about together, these are incredibly accomplished, innovative companies here in the U.S. And I know that they're making strategic decisions to offshore more of their work with their own subsidiaries and affiliates outside of the U.S. because they cannot guarantee a steady stream of qualified workers here in the United States. And I can tell you that there are a lot of foreign graduates of U.S. universities, master's and Ph.D. candidates in the hard sciences, who are being rolled out the red carpet by other countries who are welcoming them and providing visas for them and expedited green cards, and we are not there. We're losing out on those skills. So I would like to ask both the senator and the congressman to please comment on how immigration reform factors into the various issues that we've been discussing this evening.
Well, I'll start briefly, and Byron is still in the Congress, so he actually can do something about this. But I think several years ago, the United States Chamber of Commerce made what I thought was a very reasonable proposal. It's not something Congress has acted upon, is that every foreign student who gets a graduate degree in the hard sciences and related fields be handed a green card at the time he's handed his or her diploma, and so that we as a country try and retain this talent, this foreign talent that we have educated in our schools. I think that would make a great deal of sense. I often told businesses in the Dallas area when I was in Congress that it was inevitable that there was going to be a squeeze on the H-1B visa program, because I also represented a very large minority constituency, blacks and Hispanics in Fort Worth and Dallas, and there was great concern about a point I mentioned earlier, that we are not providing the type of education that talented young minority students need in this country. And so there is not a great deal of sympathy from a lot of American workers for H-1B visas when we're not providing the kind of training that our own students need to be able to fill those jobs. So this is a very complicated problem, and we have got to solve the elementary and secondary education problem in this country, because there are a lot of very talented, bright young people from poor backgrounds who do not get an adequate education in this country, and that's one of the reasons, and so they don't work their way up through the chain so that they can fill these technical positions, and that's why companies want expansion of H-1B.
and Congress reacts to that. But on the other hand, I think the for everybody who comes over here to study and who takes advantage of our system and who gets a graduate degree, they ought to get a green card.
Yeah, I don't know that I have much more to add to that. As you know, at the bottom of the economic ladder, we have not increased the minimum wage for nearly 9 years. And those who say, I can't find someone to assume these jobs, I say, you know something, maybe after 9 years, you ought to raise the folks a bit at the bottom of the ladder here. I know it's controversial. I know businesses don't want to do that. For the same reason, they seek lower wage workers in other parts of the world. They want to maintain low wage workers here. I mean, and let me just, as a part of that, there's this notion somehow that we will pull others up. You know, we'll put jobs in the Philippines and pull up their workforce and create the middle class. There's an interesting example of what goes on overseas that is identical to that which has gone on in this country. The president of the Philippines, a country in which a lot of people work for very little income, announced that she thought their minimum wage should be increased. The Carrier Corporation announced the very next day, you increase the minimum wage in the Philippines, we are out of here. They're doing exactly in those countries what they did here, resist in every circumstance the opportunity to lift others up. And so the immigration issue is a very big issue. I didn't write a book about it, but there's a couple books coming out very soon about it. And it is a portion of it, and it's tangentially related to this, because low-wage workers coming through the back door to assume these jobs are also putting pressure on the backside, even as pressure on the front side is the export of jobs here at home.
Thanks to both of you. Congressman Frost does need to leave at 7:30, and we will be taking questions up until that time and afterwards. Yes, sir.
Maybe you didn't understand my point. My point was that we ought to try and keep all those foreign-educated graduate students in the United States.
But they're the ones who are discouraging Americans from going into that field.
Well, I don't know that that's the case. I come from a family of scientists and engineers.
I'm a physicist.
And Americans, one of the problems that we have in this country in our education system, as I said, my father was an engineer. My cousin has a PhD in math from Rice. I have my mother's only brother was a chemical engineer with Phillips Petroleum. I have two cousins who have engineering degrees from Texas A&M. I have three children. They're girls. They're daughters. Two of my daughters had great math skills and were never encouraged by the public. They went to public school in this country and were never encouraged because they were women to go into technical fields. And it's a colossal failure on our education system that so many young, bright women have been discouraged from pursuing technical careers in this country until just recently. And that's something that has to be corrected. And you're not going to prevent foreign students from coming into this country because they are full tuition students. Our universities love to have foreign students here to study, because they're not scholarship students. They, by and large, pay the full freight. And I don't think you're going to tell
80% of the education is paid by the
I don't think you're going to tell our major universities that they can't have foreign students study here.
That's true.
Yes. If we could move on. Yes, ma'am, please.
I have a question about the balance of trade. A brief comment, though. 30 years ago, it was easy for women to get into the technical environment. I was one of those. I'm a golf retailer. Everything I sell is made in China. If I look at my purse, my clothes, my jewelry, it's all made in China. I see we're becoming a nation of consumers and not having a lot that we're producing to sell to the other country. 10 years from now, how are we going to balance the balance of trade deficit?
Byron has a proposal in his book. He's got a specific proposal on that.
Yeah, well, as I've said, this doesn't add up. We're headed towards real trouble. Nobody wants to talk much about it. But one of the ways that I would do it, I mean, obviously this will run into a lot of trouble from those who are helping build this current strategy of failure. I propose an idea that Warren Buffett has advanced. Warren's a friend of mine, and development of what are called import certificates. And export, you get an import certificate. The import certificates are able to be traded on an exchange, and in order to import, you have to have an import certificate. And so over a five-year period or 10-year period, whatever it is, you achieve some sort of balance. Not necessarily country to country, but generally you'll achieve some kind of balance. I think it is inevitable that we will have a weaker America, dramatically weaker America, with these kind of trade deficits. We're like the frog in the pot of water. You know, we're going to boil here, and nobody cares much about it because it's in the interests of those who are the conventional thinkers. Washington Post, New York Times, the big corporations that profit. I couldn't get an op-ed piece published by the Washington Post on this subject. And that's why I include the Washington Post in my chapter on goats. You know, I don't like calling a major newspaper a goat, but hell, they've earned it. So they get in my chapter as goats. So there.
Yes.
And I feel good about it.
He talks about that in his book, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think, you know, it's good, but it's paid. And that would be paying $10 a gallon, I guess.
Well, standardization sounds good, but standardization means lower standards in the U.S. and higher standards elsewhere, except the higher standards elsewhere aren't exactly happening. I have a chapter in this book called Oil, the Lubricant of Trade and Terrorism. I describe some of the issues. There's no free market in oil, as all of you know, and there's nothing resembling a free market in oil. But let me just talk for a moment about this issue of the unemployed in this country, low unemployment and robust economic growth. The fact is, the typical American family, the median family income is down, not up. The typical American family is doing poorer, not better. You know, it is the hourglass symptom that the professor talked about. You know, there's a story about nine guys sitting in a bar, and Bill Gates walks in, and on average, all of them are wealthy. It is absolutely true. All of them, on average, are wealthy. The nine guys that are still sitting there don't have a damn thing. But statistics allow me to make that representation to you. And were you not clever to understand it, you'd walk out of here and think, boy, that's really interesting. And that's the way our economy is described, regrettably. But you make some good points. I don't have time to talk about oil. I wish I did.
They're all yours.
Look, I've named some names in here. You ask who are the culprits. I've named some names, and I guess it's with respect to the 2.5% versus 25%. I mean, the U.S. Trade Ambassador's Office negotiates a bilateral with China, and it turns out to have been a disastrous bilateral trade agreement. And you know, you make the point, sir. Well, why don't we just be able to buy from any place? Well, what about the Chinese being able to buy from any place, or the Japanese being able to buy from any place? The fact is, virtually every other country decides what their consumers are going to have access to. You try to sell some American products in China, oh, you can occasionally get them in, but the fact is they largely keep their market closed. Send a pound of beef to Japan tonight. You know what? They need more T-bones in Japan. You know what? About 18 years after our beef agreement with Japan, there's a 50% tariff on every pound going into Japan. This is a country with an $83 billion trade deficit with us. We are weak-kneed. We don't have a spine and a backbone to say, look, this country's created something special. We're willing to trade. We're willing to expand trade opportunities. But by God, we expect trade to be fair. And if it's not fair, you go ahead and try to sell your cars in Zambia. South Korea has 99% of the cars on the road in South Korea. They're South Korean cars. You want to know why? That's what they want on the roads in Korea. We got about a few dozen Dodge Dakotas. The reason I like that is because of the word Dakota. A few dozen Dodge Dakota pickups got into South Korea, and all of a sudden the consumers started to like them. Their government shut them down just like that. I've written about that in the book. They don't want anything to do with this fair trade stuff. They don't want anything to do with it. They believe we're Uncle Suckers. They can send everything that they produce here into our sponge of a marketplace and have access to it here by our consumers. But when it comes to fair trade on the other side, South Korea sent us 700,000 cars last year. You know how many American cars we sold in South Korea? 4,000. Fair trade? Not on your life.
Why is there
Sorry.
Actually, I wanted to kind of just make a couple of comments, both on the first question that was raised about higher education. It's interesting because, you know, you're right in that it's we don't see enough American students in graduate programs. The interesting question is what's causing that? Is it the inflow of cheap foreign students, or is it something else? I think it's a number of factors. Let me give you some examples. We have tried through the years, through all kinds of mechanisms, including providing many times more financial aid to domestic students than to international students, to attract students. And we found that, you know, even when we get to the point where the amount of financial aid in a graduate program is about what a person with a bachelor's degree can earn on the market, we still have a hard time getting students. And the reason is that for a long time, the opportunities were so good for the students who were in science and technology, even without getting into graduate programs, that the pressure to actually go into graduate programs was much less. So that's you know, one factor that makes a difference. Another is that, as the congressman was mentioning, you know, when you look at these early education stages, we don't condition our students to think about careers in science and technology the same way it happens in other countries. And even with that, you know, if you say, well, you know, all these people in China and India and so on are in science and technology, actually even that's not true, because the number of students, even in those places that are in science and technology, is actually not that different in terms of percentages from those in this country. The problems are that the numbers are so huge. I mean, for instance, there's only about 3 to 5% of the top level of the population that gets an excellent education in many of these countries, but that's a huge number. And so you get to get many of these folks wanting to come over here and so on. And then just one other comment to the lady about the manufacturing, the golf thing. What's interesting is that when you look at the cost structure of some of your what goods and services, what we find is that the actual cost of manufacturing is a lot smaller in terms of the total cost. So you have all these other service elements and functions that go into that end up being a basis for white collar employment in this country. The reason why a lot of people justify that is they say, well, if the total cost is a lot less of the product, you're selling a lot more golf equipment and garments and so on to a much larger market. I mean, that's why people in every walk of society in this country can afford Nike shoes, right? Because they're cheaper and because the overall cost is lower. So I think that's part of that's what complicates the problem. You are able to do well as a business owner because of that ability to reduce that component. The problem is, as I was saying earlier, what happens when all those service components also start going overseas?
We have time for about one more question before our formal presentation has to wrap up. Sir?
What do you feel is the...
Yeah, if North Dakota were a country, not a state, we're a country, we would rank second in the world in eighth grade math and sciences. And I one of the top education experts in the world who writes and thinks and speaks about this said to me, I would have been able to tell you that without knowing a thing about your teachers or your students. All I'd have to do is take a look at the type of population you have, how much do they move, what percent are divorced, what's the family structure, and then I could tell you what's going to come out of your schools. I wouldn't need to know much more than that, he said. It's not about tests. It's not about the quality of teachers. It's about the homogeneity of the community, about the family structure. And I think I tend to agree with that. I mean, this notion of no child left behind, Ann Richards says no child's behind is left. That's just an empty slogan. Does anybody know of anybody on the other side that says, you know what my platform is? I believe in leaving children behind, by God. You know, it's just, so leave no child behind. That means nothing. Unless you try to address a whole series of things, yes, in the schools, and we certainly need to do better, especially in schools and neighborhoods where they don't have the same tax structure and the same contribution to build good schools. But Most of it is whatever else is being brought to school in the communities. I've gone to third grade, fourth grade classes, teacher of the year, and I asked these kids. I remember going to one. I asked these kids just for fun. We were talking about various things. They were asking questions. I said, "I'm asking how many in this room? I think they were third or fourth graders. How many in this room are able to watch R movies at home, R-rated movies?" Half of the class. Their parents let them watch R-rated movies in fourth grade. Unbelievable. You know what? They bring all of that to school with them. The language. You know, the culture of an R. So, you know, it is not rocket science to figure out how we put together better schools and how to fix what's wrong with school.
Senator, aren't you sure it's just so cold in the winter in North Dakota to stay home and study?
Well, I'm going to tell you something about that. Because of that insensitive statement. It was 3 weeks ago, in case you're not paying attention every night, you should be, but you may not be. It was 3 weeks ago, 112 degrees in Bismarck. I came to Dallas to cool off with that. 112 degrees in Bismarck. And you tell me something's not going on with the climate.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap up our formal presentation.
Can we ask that fellow? I walked in with him, and he was one of the first ones here. Can we let him ask his question? Yes, sir. Listen, I'm gonna be out there signing these books. If you'd like to purchase a book, this is full of some interesting, provocative, funny stories, and also I think some good solutions. I'm really pleased all of you came, and I'm pleased the professor was here as well. Thank you very much.
In fact, Senator, if Georgianne Geyer was here a few weeks ago, she said any book that deserves to be read, and yours certainly does, deserves to be purchased. And as you know, this is one of the ways that we get such wonderful speakers who take time out of their busy schedules to come to Dallas-Fort Worth. So please, I know I'm going to be out there buying the book because Martin Frost took my copy. So I better buy a copy.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.